This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Recycling isn't profitable. It's costly. Yeah, it would be less expensive if people figured out how to do it right.
We really do have to train the consumer. When in doubt, throw it out. Contamination is the biggest thing.
Illinois State University Recycling Coordinator Andrew Bennett and other experts talk with GLT's Eric Stock. Plus, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner stops by to talk with Ryan Denham about a public spat with Councilmember Johnny Painter. Mary Cullen dives into the archives of the history of addiction. Chestnut Health Systems has some of the most comprehensive in the nation. And GLT's Grow looks at a native plant in Illinois you might not expect, prickly pear cactus. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington City Council has pumped the brakes on several city board and commission appointments. Council members have also formally established the boundaries of the downtown cultural district. Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with GLT's Ryan Denham to talk about actions and other issues from last night's council meeting.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Yeah, always wonderful to be here, Ryan. Thank you.
So, Mayor Renner, why was a normally routine thing, the appointment of volunteers to the city's Transportation Commission and Property Maintenance Review Board, suddenly not so routine last night? What happened?
Well, that's a good question. I'm still not totally sure. This has never happened in my 6 years as being mayor. I think some of it's conditioned by some of the controversy surrounding Connect Transit. And I know there were some issues with a couple of the specific appointees. But if that's the case, then you should bring out those appointees or actually talk to the mayor beforehand, which is usually how these things are, you know, should be handled. So it was certainly not our finest hour. And I did call Brad Cole of the Illinois Municipal League and asked him, you know, what are some of the traditional ways that this is handled? And we're actually just about as open as you can get. Council members get an application form, which is almost unheard of in similarly situated cities, a week or so in advance. And you would think that people would pick up the phone and call the mayor and if they've got some concerns or whatever, or come talk to me. You know, could be one-on-one.
So you're saying that council members have enough time and information, in your view, to ahead
absolutely.
Of time on these appointees?
Absolutely, yeah. And we're leading the state in that regard, yeah, in terms of openness. No, but at the end of the day, though, there is a separation of powers issue that I talked about last night, and that is there's a good reason why legislative bodies don't appoint. They are in a reactive mode, and that's the case for the U.S. Senate. That's the case for state senates. And that is a singular executive ultimately weighs a bunch of different factors and makes recommendations. You don't like the recommendation? You know, we'll send you another one. Now, there are some, for example, if there's a vacancy, and this is why I mentioned last night, Alderman Milwambwe, if you have a vacancy on the city council, the city council has to approve the mayor's appointment, but they only get two shots at it. Their role as advice and consent is discharge if they say no twice. So the role of a legislature is inherently in a different realm than that of the executive. And so I think it was also unfortunate that we're going to spend time with, I think, what seems to me to be the painful elaboration of the obvious, and that is what are the duties of board and commission members, et cetera. They're specified in our ordinances already. I was hoping that the committee, the whole meeting, that the council wants to now talk about this, we could have focused on capital projects like the O'Neill Pool on the west side or something tangible rather than, for me, this is, I think it's unfortunate, navel-gazing.
So the Transportation Commission is a body that normally has 8 members. I think today it's down to 4. For example, its chair, Michael Gorman, is leaving the community.
I thought we were told last night it was 5.
5, okay. So you're at 5.
So, but if somebody does not leave, if somebody leaves or is not there, or
yeah,
can't
how does that
attend,
affect the
quorum will go down. And that was made clear to the council, but the council went forward anyway. And they mixed appointments with evaluating the process, which just seems also so bizarre to me. Okay, handle the appointments that are in front of you rather than to say, well, you know, we're going to look at the entire process. I mean, these people were appointed under a particular set of rules, and now you're going to change the rules as their names come forward. This is not going to make it easier for us as a community to get people who are going to come forward, give their time and energy to the city out of the goodness of their heart to serve on our boards and commissions if they're potentially going to be used as a political football in public. And I think we've seen that with the Connect Transit Board. We've seen that with these latest appointments. And this is just very unfortunate. This is not Bloomington's finest hour.
So you've mentioned the Connect Transit Board a couple of times here. How do you think last night's concerns relate to that ongoing issue with, you know, some concerns of the community about Connect Transit's leadership and how they've approached fare changes, route cuts, right, that kind of thing?
Well, there were people. I don't know if it's the connection that you may have mentioned. I think it's the concern over some people were opposing the 2 appointees that I put forward, who I think are absolutely outstanding appointees, 2 of the best people to really balance the things that are necessary.
Is this his former Alderman Amelia Burgess and Planning Commission Chair Justin Boyd?
Correct. So people who are familiar with our downtown plan, who've been on the downtown task force, who are also familiar with our comprehensive plan, which also includes multimodal transit as well, and clearly people who have been empathetic in their decision-making in the past, that frankly, I'd be insulted if somebody told me, if I were one of them, and they told me that I couldn't understand and I was incapable of understanding the plight of the less fortunate. I think they're outstanding appointees. At this point, I'm not going to push them forward because it's clear that the council majority will say no. We'll see if that lasts. Again, this is playing politics with something. Just to back up on Connect Transit, there are actually 5 appointees in the next year that are coming before the Connect Transit Board. And some people, a very small number, are focusing on 2 appointments. So there are 2 that are up in Bloomington, 1 that's coming up in a year, and there are 2 one this year, 1 next year in Normal. So there are 5 appointees that are coming up in Bloomington and Normal, even if we don't expand the size of the board, where we can add, and I think it's important to add, the diversity that many have been asking for. I've been a favor since before I got elected mayor of increased diversity on all our boards and commissions so that the boards and commissions look more like our community.
So if not former Alderman Burgess and Justin Boyd, then who? Have you already decided who you're going to?
No, I'm not going down that path. I'm sticking to this group. I think these are sound decisions. We will see what happens. I may wait, as Mayor Coos is going to do, you know, until the work group that's dealing with Connect Transit is finished with their work, and that I understand will be in early fall.
Now, has Citizens to Ensure Fair Transit, which I think is this group that we've been referencing, have they floated names to you? Have they provided suggestions of like, all right, this person would work for us? Does that person work for you?
Yes. Absolutely, there are people there that are that I think are, at least one actually filled out an application, I think would be a very strong candidate. Absolutely. So that might very well be someone that I would appoint to, you know, next year or in a future appointment. We're going to see. We'll see how this all plays out. At this point, it is disappointing. It's the first time I've had this kind of issue in 6 years as being mayor. The mayor appoints, weighs all the options, and presents to the council. The council has the advice and consent role. But the advice and consent role is, quite clearly in the Illinois Constitution and by political practice, it is somewhat limited. Ours, we do try as much as possible. And I will give Mayor Stockton credit for this, the previous mayor, he instituted the forms in 2011. And I think that's a good idea. That is not just to dump names on people. I remember being on the county board in McLean County, and all you had were names, and you know there was almost no, unless it was an elected official that you were appointing, almost no real contact between county board members and the county board chair. This is in the old days.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, I want to ask you about some comments you apparently made at the mayor's open house meeting last Friday at City Hall. There's a video I saw floating around online. It looks like you're asked a question during this open forum about diversity, and you say something along the lines of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, quote, does not behave like someone who is an African American. Can you elaborate and explain what you meant by that comment?
Well, it was certainly a poor choice of words. I was saying that essentially what we sometimes call descriptive representation, just because somebody is of a particular racial group or maybe is a particular ethnic group, does not necessarily mean that they will represent that group and its broader interests. So the snippet that you're talking about was promoted by a blogger who only conveniently, well, one, misquoted me, and two, only put in part of a very long conversation. There were people from the media who were there, and many other people. That was a very well-attended group. Nobody asked me a question about that until about 48 hours later. So
yeah,
anyway,
and you can't see in the video,
what
question you were asked, and then the beginning or end of your comments even. So what question even prompted that? Since I haven't actually seen it,
I haven't actually even seen it. I've heard second to your comments about it, but we were talking about representation broadly, right? So I'm not really going to be in a position where I discuss what someone, a single person who doesn't even live in our community is a blogger, puts on a blog. But
so I think here you're referencing Diane Benjamin, who runs the BLN news site.
And I don't mention her name. I would assume that especially if you're dealing with regular news, I'm not quite sure even why GLT would mention her, because there's not much that's terribly credible there. But anyway, going back to what the main theme of the open house was that I have every 2 weeks is a broader representation on all boards and commissions and who do boards and commissions look like Bloomington? Yes, they look much more like Bloomington today with the nearly 300 board and commission members than they did 4 years ago. We have gays, we have straights, we have people from the west side, east side, we have people of color as well as white people, we have younger people and millennials as well as older people, and that was not the case 6 years ago. We, other than the Human Relations Commission, we basically had a bunch of old middle-aged and old white guys. Nothing wrong with middle-aged white guys, I'm one, right? But you need to have some degree of diversity in terms of opinions, and I think you make better decisions when you have more diversity of ideas and thoughts and perspectives, because obviously we are all functions of how we are raised and our life experiences. And my life experiences are different from yours and from other people. And understanding that is critical to making board and commission appointments.
And so I think that does clarify the point you're trying to make about descriptive representation. And to be fair, GLT does not often cite BLN News as a provider of content on our air, but in this case, I think
the local media generally cites somebody who doesn't live in our community and is a single person who's espousing their views. If somebody sat on a street corner and did it every day, you probably wouldn't pay much attention to them.
No, I think that's totally fair. Regardless, you made the comment and you just yourself said it was
right.
A poor choice of words, right?
Right, absolutely.
Okay. One last thing before I cut you loose. This does circle back to last night's city council meeting. City council members unanimously approved the creation of the Downtown Cultural District, which is the kind of the work product of the
Cultural
Commission.
I think that's a good thing we did last night.
Yeah, so let's focus on that for a second.
Yeah.
What is the goal there, and why was that created and formalized?
Well, for a variety of reasons. One, it does then allow the city to do more overt planning, but also to apply for grants. We now can, in a sense, make the ask that we have gotten our act together And we have a particular cultural district that includes the following boundaries. This is adjacent to our downtown, has the following demographic characteristics. This is how this particular project would fit in. This is why if you give us a grant for the Creativity Center, for example, this is the impact that it's going to have on the particular area in the neighborhood. So, yes, I think that this is long overdue, and I was very happy to see that this happened. This is a critical point, part of improving the quality of life in our community generally, and arts, and our downtown in particular.
And so this wasn't a formal district before? I feel like I've heard the term, like, cultural district for years and years.
Yeah, there are signs up, but this is what made it legal in an ordinance.
Gotcha. Yeah. Signs do not equal legal ordinance.
Yeah, right. Unfortunately.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot,
Sound
Ryan.
Ideas.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos.
Support for GLT's summer concert comes from Night Shop, downtown Bloomington's destination for food, craft beer, and live music, and proud sponsor of the free GLT summer concert June 8th, featuring 3rd Street Down and headliner Adia Victoria. Concert details at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, all about recycling with Eric Stock. Bloomington Normal is home to one of the largest and most diverse addiction archives in the U.S. From alcohol to opioids to marijuana, GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with former CEO of Chestnut Health Systems, Russ Hagen, about how the history of addiction parallels the present.
The Illinois Addiction Archives was really the primary dream of Bill White, who was one of the first individuals who worked at Chestnut Health Systems. He went away. He was here when I came to work here. And he and I are both keenly interested in history in general. And through a lot of discussions, we really kind of bemoaned the fact that there was no real repository for a keen look at the history of addiction and treatment in the U.S. And so the archives came out of those discussions.
If I could have you get into how the treatment of addiction has changed over the years?
There were really back into the early and middle 1800s, there were societies, the Washingtonians and others, who were almost groups of companions and people who suffered with addiction, who kind of banded together to support and help one another. And those were some of the first attempts to treat addiction. And it's a you know, 2-hour long documentary, if not more, to talk about the various attempts through the decades in order to treat addiction. But I think the modern era of addiction treatment really got started in the middle 1930s when Alcoholics Anonymous was first established, and that it was then on that basis that there was a feeling that, in addition to AA, that some people really needed something more. And that's when you see the beginnings of places like Chestnut Health System, which started in the early 70s, others in the 60s, where actually people could go and, in addition to AA, find help and support in a community of people. So when we first started providing treatment, we were one among many organizations all over the country where people could come either for a period of time and live residentially, or come to outpatient groups and be with other people who had addiction problems and support and help one another.
Could I have you tell me a little bit about why the archives are here, maybe how they got started?
Well, as I mentioned, Bill White and I began to study the history of addiction and treatment in the U.S. and really came to the conclusion that the field of addiction lacked what other fields often have. So if you study nursing, there's probably going to be a kind of a history and philosophy of nursing. If you study medicine, there'll be a history and philosophy of medicine. If you study psychology, there'll be a history and philosophy of psychology. There was really no single place where anybody had really studied the history and the philosophy of addiction. And Bill and I felt that was a huge void, particularly in the archives, although it is a place where there is just an enormous amount of literature that could be used by researchers. When Bill wrote his book, Slaying the Dragon, it was really to help people who were themselves counselors and working with people who had addiction problems. So we wanted a place where people who were interested in having a better understanding of the history that led them to wherever they were at that point in the field, they could go and study and read and understand better where things had been.
With the addiction archives, what do we know about the history of addiction leading up to it being defined as a disease?
That has a really interesting history, because you can go back into actually the early 1800s, and there was a physician who actually was the first to call addiction a disease. And then through history, it has been characterized in many different ways as moral weakness, as a religious issue in terms of lack of spirituality, and it really is one of those issues that both the professional community, whether it be counselors or physicians more currently, or the general public, community leaders and others, have really struggled to say what is this.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Russ Hagen, the former CEO of Chestnut Health Systems. I think the main focus in this day and age is talking about the opioid crisis. In Illinois, it's a topic that we talk about constantly. Legislators try and legislate it, but I think it'd be really interesting to hear from you about how the history of addiction has led us to this opioid crisis, really.
Actually, the opioid crisis currently is probably not the first opioid crisis in the United States. For example, post-Civil War, there were a lot of Civil War veterans who were treated with morphine, which is a powerful pain reliever. And given the state of medicine, they gave it pretty liberally and pretty freely. So if they survived the war, they often came home addicted to morphine. And there are other periods then through history where the use of heroin was quite common, and it's obviously an opioid. And then as science and chemists got busy in the pharmaceutical companies, they created synthetic substitutes for things like morphine and heroin and those kinds of things. So the current crisis really is maybe the third or fourth crisis in 150 years. But it is an incredibly powerful drug, very seductive. People find that it does do what it's supposed to do, which is it relieves pain, but it also has these other effects, and it creates a lot of euphoria and feelings of well-being, and that is really kind of what I think hooks people into opiates, whether they are things like heroin or manufactured pharmaceuticals, is that they deal with their pain, but then they like the way they feel. above and beyond the pain relief.
Reading some articles that were put out by Chestnut over recent years, there's one about heroin's early history, and it says heroin first entered medical use in 1898 as a non-addictive alternative to morphine and codeine, like you were just alluding to now. So could I have you talk a little bit about how heroin's early history kind of parallels with alcohol? And I know during Prohibition, alcohol was prescribed by doctors, and how those two substances have really grown from their early roots.
The struggle with addictive substances, whether it be alcohol or morphine or cocaine or heroin or opium, is a long one, and oftentimes through the history of addiction in our country, there were periods when they substituted one substance for another, again, as you say, to treat morphine addiction with heroin, not realizing that the substitute was every bit as addicting and damaging as the other, which is also true. There was a lot of use of cocaine to treat heroin addiction. And this is just kind of a cycle as people began to recognize that addiction really was a severe health and social problem in our country and how to help people who were suffering from addiction-related issues.
Now, today, a hot topic in Illinois and really across the country is legalization of recreational marijuana. Medically, in Illinois, marijuana has been legal for a few years now. Is this history repeating itself?
It is, perhaps to a certain degree. The issue of legalizing marijuana obviously is one that is a topic of discussion all over the country. It's complicated because from a purely pharmacological point of view, you can make a case that marijuana is less damaging from a health point of view than alcohol is, and alcohol is legal, and that's often one of the arguments that is used by those who advocate for its legalization. The problem is that it adds another legalized substance that is addictive, and I think what people might not realize is that in the 1960s and 70s, the marijuana that was available was much less potent than the marijuana that is available today because they've learned how to hybrid it and grow it and that kind of thing. So it's much more powerful. It's, in my opinion, it's not really an issue of, it's not going to help treat addiction at all. It just adds a legal substance to the menu of potentially addicting drugs.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Russ Hagen, former CEO of Chestnut Health Systems.
Pancakes without syrup, cereal without milk, something is missing. Morning Edition without a full menu of stories, that is not quite right either. Sure, you listen for the big news, but you'll also hear reports on science, music, books, sports, even your own well-being. Make your morning complete. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's also local news. I'm Morning Edition host John Norton. Listen 4 to 9 a.m. weekdays on GLT.
Support for GLT's summer concert comes from Rhonda Glenn Law Offices, practicing family law, including adoption and child custody, for more than 30 years. Rhonda Glenn Law Offices will be at summer concert on June 8th with Rebirth Brass Band and headliner Adia Victoria. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, GLTs grow and a native plant, cactus, in Illinois. Recycling advocates in McLean County are pushing back against claims that materials set out at the curb for recycling are going to the landfill or being burned. As GLT's Eric Stock reports, advocates' biggest concern is that a lack of attention to what we are and are not setting aside for recycling drives up costs.
There's a lot of garbage and some recycling.
When students flood out of the dorms at Illinois State University to head home for the summer, Andrew Bennett becomes a dumpster diver. He lunges into a 4-foot-tall rollout dumpster, but he's not looking for hidden treasures. He's looking for material that could be recycled.
It's in my heart, in my blood, to keep stuff out of the landfills, and it's, you know, trying to do good.
It's also part of his job as ISU's recycling coordinator. Bennett spends much of move-out week pouring through dumpsters to make sure trashed items can't be salvaged. He cordons off an area to put recyclable materials, but he says it never fails.
It's amazing that students will toss a metal futon up into a garbage roll-off 6 feet, 4 feet high, rather than acknowledging there's a sign there that says we take this metal roll-off, metal futon frame, and they can just drop it on the ground.
Bennett came to ISU in 2010 just as the university was preparing to convert to single-stream recycling. He says that led to a large spike in recycling on campus, not all of it good.
There's the recycling wannabes that think everything can be recycled. Things like plastic hangers or plastic bags. That's the big thing that curbside does not want.
In some cases, Bennett says the problem is just laziness.
We see to-go containers that end up in our recycling when the trash chute is even closer, and we have signs for that.
And no, you can't recycle pizza boxes. There are lots of those on college campuses. Bennett says that leads to more contamination if no one catches it. And the only way to catch it is to have personnel go through the materials bit by bit. And that drives up cost.
They really didn't educate enough. And it's hard for even me to educate. I'm one of the lone educators trying to educate students.
Bennett says his office has tried posting more visible signs at each recycling bin what can and can't be accepted, but that doesn't always help. Surely college campuses aren't the only place where recycling contamination exists. It's a problem just about everywhere. That's why companies that take recyclables are investing millions of dollars to better weed out the materials that may cause contamination. That's the sound of an optical sorter, the key piece of an estimated $3 million renovation at Midwest Fiber Recycling in Normal. Todd Shoemaker, who runs the plant, explains how it works.
So as material is coming in through, it's coming through at a rapid pace, and then it takes an infrared picture, and then a puff of air shoots the plastic or the aluminum or the tin care up and over a divider, and all the paper falls on one side of the divider, and all the containers shoot over to the other side of the divider.
So how did you do it before this?
Before, unfortunately, some of this would end up in our fiber. So some of those smashed water bottles, how they've gotten so thin and so lightweight, when they go through some of our sorting, they would end up in the paper. So we just have people there trying to find it, but they couldn't find enough of them.
Even with machines to separate items, sorting recyclables is labor-intensive, especially at a plant that churns out about 3,000 tons of material each month. Staff work a conveyor belt line where they have to hand-pick all of the milk jugs and laundry detergent bottles and the harder plastics, which are recycled separately from the lighter plastics, aluminum, and tin cans.
Every minute, they're finding 50 items in that area. So you can see they're sorting with their left hand, their right hand. We sometimes joke, usually if you're good at video games, you're pretty good at this job because it's pretty fast moving and your hands are always moving, that hand-eye coordination.
They also have to remove contaminants, really stinky contaminants. He says the most common offenders are pieces of clothing, plastic bags, and diapers. Yes, dirty diapers, which can tangle in equipment. Midwest Fiber takes recyclables from about a million commercial and residential customers throughout Illinois, including Bloomington Normal and parts of Iowa. As many as 9 staffers at a time do manual sorting. After the big sort, Shoemaker works the phones to find buyers. China stopped taking U.S. materials a few years ago because of contamination problems. He says that has turned the recycling market on its head. Some materials can't find a home, at least not a cost-effective one. Some recycled material goes to waste, but Shoemaker says not at Midwest Fiber.
There's stories that come out of Nebraska of recyclers having to landfill material. And fortunately, where we're at geographically and our selling strategy, that's not a really a concern of ours. We have enough domestic paper mills and we have enough good people here to make sure we have a good, clean quality product that we will have a market.
Shoemaker says they can store materials at a warehouse if they can't sell them right away. They did that recently when their plant went offline for 3 weeks during the renovations. And not all recycling materials are equal. Cardboard has plummeted in value in the last year. Shoemaker says that's in part because there's more of it.
10 years ago, 50 dress shirts would ship to Sears in one box. And that Sears would take the box out of the market, and that would get recycled, and the shirts would get put on the shelf. Now, 50 shirts, no longer from Sears, but from wherever, get shipped to your house, and each one of those creates a box.
As recently as a year ago, ISU's Andrew Bennett says Midwest paid $100 a ton for cardboard. Now he gets about $5 a ton. Some materials face such a poor recycling market, recyclers won't take them. Area Disposal Service of Peoria, a recycler in central Illinois and parts of Missouri and Iowa, operates landfills in Clinton and Hopedale, Illinois, and Pike County, Missouri. Company spokesman Eric Shangra says Area Disposal will no longer recycle glass.
We took a load of 21 tons of glass to a processor in Wisconsin. And between taking it up there with the truck and bringing the truck back, we made $6. And you can't run a business on making $6 on a 21 tons worth of material.
And that was before the company added labor and transportation costs. Just like Midwest Fiber, Shangra says Area Disposal put in a multi-million dollar recycling processing system at its facility in Pekin. The company recently signed its first municipal recycling contract in Hayworth that excludes glass. Shangra says glass left in the recycling bin will end up in the landfill.
And I know it's hard on people when they wash out that cottage cheese container or wash out that Ragu bottle that they've done for so long and they want it recycled and they put it in. That's annoying to them when they hear it's going in the landfill. But that's the reality of the marketplace.
Different companies taking different materials adds confusion. And Ecology Action Center Director Michael Brown says this is at a time the recycling industry wants a simple, unified message to encourage more people to recycle.
Some sectors will have one list of acceptable items, and then for others, there's a slightly different list. And so it does complicate our messaging somewhat.
The Ecology Action Center in Normal has set a county-wide goal of recycling 50% of trash by the year 2022. It's currently 42%. Brown says customers should be confident that when they recycle according to the directions, that's exactly what will happen.
We have very high confidence because of strong relationships and just the transparency with these local companies of what's going on, that things are being recycled when people say they're being recycled.
Recycling costs money, especially when markets dwindle. Normal Public Works Director Wayne Aldridge says municipalities have to pay more.
I would say the price has basically doubled since this time last year, so we are concerned with this trend.
Aldridge says the average monthly recycling haul was about 150 tons through the town of Normal curbside and drop-off programs. That cost the town about $90,000 a year, about twice what it was a year ago. Aldridge says that part of the town's budget has some flexibility for now.
I think we're still comfortable with funding the program at this point. It will certainly be something we discuss and study in greater detail when we go through our budget process beginning in July.
Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Card says the days municipalities could make money recycling are long gone. Picard says recycling is still cheaper than hauling it to the landfill. City pays $45 a ton for recycling and about $53 a ton for trash. Card says it's a challenge to encourage more people to recycle, but not haphazardly.
It's been hard over the years to try to encourage the right type of recycling.
Card says about 80% of residents recycle something, but he'd like to see those who do recycle to do more.
Much of the material in your home, you know, about 70% of a lot of what you take in, it can be recycled. So there really are a lot of opportunities if people are willing to put in that time to try to reduce the materials that go to the landfill.
High Issues Andrew Bennett offers a word of caution. He says before you toss something in the recycling bin, make sure that's where it should go.
We really do have to train the consumer to just, when in doubt, throw it out. That's contamination is the biggest thing.
If residents don't get smarter at recycling, municipalities may one day have to decide whether they can still afford to pay for recycling when the county no longer has its own landfill. The county's trash is now being taken to Livingston County. I'm Eric Stock.
Bloomington Normal and the Ecology Action Center each have specifics on how and what to recycle on their websites. Bloomington residents can also get more information on the Recycle Coach app. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A plant you might expect to find in the desert southwest is native to central Illinois, and it's easy to grow, edible, might even have medical benefits. GLT's Mike McCurdy and ISU's Patrick Murphy talk about the prickly pear cactus in this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow.
When you think of cactus, you might think of deserts, but some cacti are native to Illinois. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick, thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Good to be with you, Mike.
So what kind of cactus is found in Illinois and even in central Illinois?
Prickly pear cactus is the one that we can say fits into both of those categories, and it represents about a dozen species of Apuntia. I love that term, Apuntia genus of cactus and the Cactaceae family. These populate North American deserts, and all of them have a very similar appearance with a flat, fleshy pad that look like large leaves, but they're actually modified branch and stem structures, and they serve the functions of water storage, of course, photosynthesis. They produce flowers. They're an overlooked treasure, I think. Mm. They're a solution to a lot of gardeners' difficult scenarios as well.
If a landscaper or a gardener, a home gardener, wanted to put these into the landscape, there is a way to do that.
Yeah, they're very easy to transplant, and you can just take a little slice of a pad and put it down in a narrow furrow in the ground and give it some water. But it is a plant that likes fast draining, usually rocky, gravelly, or sandy type soils. So if you had a boulevard and you're having trouble getting grass to grow there, that would be a possibility for one to consider, and they could amend the soil simply by adding pea gravel or sand.
So how do they fit into the ecosystem, for instance? Do they add anything back to the soil in some way, or are they a food source for other animals or insects?
They are a food source for a few animals. They're a habitat for lots of small animals, and they're oftentimes found in areas where there's not a lot of other things growing, or there's a really predetermined company that comes with it, but they don't restore or enrich soils like, say, a legume might do. They might, in some cases, because of where they would be located, that's a south and west exposure where that's the hot and sunniest, they could be a natural barrier to some plants to protect them against foraging and stuff. So if there are grasses or other plants that are growing inside these cacti, that's a possibility because that's how they're mixed in nature. There's some protection afforded to those other plants that are mixed within them.
So they protect the plants, and then any animals like field mice or something might use that as a natural habitat other animals can't get to them because of the spines of the cactus.
Right. Reptiles. Yeah. Excellent.
How does the abundance of water in central Illinois, especially during the spring, affect these cacti? I've killed many succulents and cacti by overwatering them.
It's certainly a possibility, and if it's in a spot that's not well draining, you know, because that's what you get with sandy, rocky, gravelly type soils, it could be in a spot where it's retaining water. That's something that you may be able to fix, or it could be an indication that it's not really the perfect plant for that spot, you know.
I'm always surprised when I come across cactus in Illinois. I guess I shouldn't be, but I'm always, you know, when I'm hiking and I see a cactus, it's always something sort of special, I guess, because it's they stand out, and those yellow flowers stand out as well on the prickly pear. But they are fairly common, and they're found in a lot of other states as well.
They have a character that's different from many other plants. They're found in all the deserts of the American Southwest, and based on having adapted to local elevations and ranges, that's when you see their other 15 or so species that go with the prickly pear that we see here in Illinois. In Illinois, for that matter, Mike, it's down in there's some sandy flat kind of alluvial areas along the river in southwest Illinois. That's where you would go and see them in large numbers, kind of mixed in with some grasses and probably some other pines and cottonwoods and things like that.
I think it's interesting how plants can help people. Obviously, we consume or eat some of them, but we're also finding all kinds of compounds in plants in the rainforests, for instance, that have medical applications. And the prickly pear right here in central Illinois might also have similar benefits.
Yeah, and, you know, that's kind of the spirit of what I wanted to talk with you about the prickly pear, was because there has been interest in the prickly pear plant. Lots of cultures have eaten this plant, and some have realized a lowering of their blood glucose levels based on this water-soluble fiber that comes with ingesting properly prepared prickly pear cactus pads. But like a lot of other things we've talked about, there's really no 100% conclusive AMA, you know, backed evidence to suggest that it happens. It's more on anecdotal side. But even if that wasn't your goal, it's tasty. It's good to eat, and it's something that is, I find interesting because I think edible landscapes are not only fashionable, but they make a lot of sense.
Well, let's talk about eating them. In the old westerns, you'd see characters dig into a cactus for the moisture content, but you can actually just eat these or prepare them in a recipe. And I guess I'd start off by asking you, what does it taste like?
Well, to me, it's...
And don't say chicken.
No, it doesn't. To me, it tastes like a combination of, say, like mango and a little of asparagus.
Huh.
Don't know if it makes your pee smell funny. I haven't eaten that much of it.
That's a whole nother edition
That's
of Grow.
Right,
we can
right.
talk about the compounds in asparagus and related plants that would make that can give urine a smell.
Yeah, and that's why asparagus is so insecure, I think, is from that funny smell.
I love asparagus.
Yeah. There's a part of the pear that's actually a flower that's kind of a purpley pinkish color. It's like looks like a large grape. That's considered a fruit, where the meat that you get from the prepared pad is considered a vegetable.
Hmm.
And then the pear has a heart, you know, kind of like, you know, an artichoke has a heart. And these are all the parts of the pear that one can consume.
So why is the fruit of the prickly pear sometimes called tuna? I assume it doesn't have any relationship to the flavor of tuna.
I don't know. I'm not sure. And that's the best I can do. That's just the lingo.
That's just weird.
That.
So
yeah. So
what about are they protected? Can you harvest them in the wild? You talked about transplanting them. So if I come across one, can I harvest a pad? Leave the plant intact. You know, don't dig up the whole plant for one pad, but
yeah,
harvest a pad and prepare it as I'm hiking or camping.
I think one could if they were on private property. We have to remind everybody that it's illegal in most cases and discouraged to leave or take anything from a state, federal, or county park. but you could easily forage on this, you know. So if you're hiking in Flagstaff, Arizona, and you know, enjoying all the pinyon pines and all that nature has to offer there, if one was able to enjoy some prickly pear cactus around the campfire without, you know, injuring themselves, I think that that would be fine. I think it's taking it out of there that you might get in trouble, right?
But if it's on private property and you wanted to transplant one to your yard, you could probably successfully do that.
Absolutely.
What's the root structure like? Shallow?
Root structure, small, shallow, like human hair, usually confined within whatever shadow the cactus casts on the ground. It's not a long-running root system like with a woody plant or even a herbaceous plant. It's kind of confined.
And let's talk about actually handling these when you're transplanting,
right,
or wanting to prepare them to eat. You use a phrase called, glauca? So are those the spines?
They are, and some of them are tiny that you can barely even see them. And then, you know, this is another reason that, like, foxes and coyotes and a smart domestic dog would keep away from them, is because they can be pushed into your flesh really easy.
So it's not the big spines you have to worry about, although those will hurt, but it's the little ones that will work in like a splinter, maybe.
That's right. And but when you're outside transplanting, you're definitely going to want to have leather gloves, and maybe you want a tong so you can hold that little leaf up so you're kind of burying the cut portion of the pad in the earth.
If you have any questions about gardening or cactus, we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find this and past editions of Grow at wglt.org. Subscribe to this and all of GLT's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, Ryan Dunham, and Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.